Well, here we are.
Sure. In Easter week, right, leading up to Sunday, Divine Mercy Sunday, and it's like, you know, we were in studio last week in the midst of all the Holy Week celebrations, and it's a week later. Where has the time gone? But amazing liturgies, and I don't know about you, but I must have read the Pope's various homilies two or three times. They were powerful, insightful homilies. Two, of course, on Holy Thursday, then his words at the Colosseum on Good Friday. Obviously, the Easter Vigil was extraordinarily beautiful, as Easter Vigils always are around the world. Very, very beautiful words there. Then you had, not many hours after that, it must have seemed like to the Holy Father, the Sunday morning, Easter Sunday morning Mass. And he doesn't give a homily for that, though, but mm-hmm. it's the Urbi and Orbi blessing.
Well, it's really the holiest week of the year, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful in many ways. I mean, I remember as a child saying, I couldn't understand why Easter was so special and holy and why Christmas wasn't. Because as a kid, I remember asking the nuns in school and my mom and dad, but if Jesus wasn't born, then he couldn't die. You know, so why wouldn't Christmas be that's obviously the mind of a child, but why would Christmas not be the more special of the two? And they were explaining it was the resurrection. He had to die to be resurrected. He died and was resurrected, you know, because of our sins, because of the fall of man. And that was the basic explanation I remember getting as a child. And all of the liturgies point to that, and you look at the institution like Thursday. That is so special, Holy mm-hmm. Thursday, because, mm-hmm. of course, you have the institution of the priesthood, the institution of the sacrament of the Eucharist. And you can tell how much all this meant to the Holy Father in his various homilies and his always attempting to explain to us what he knows and even what he feels about certain liturgical events, because we know how important the liturgy is to him. And God bless him, he's resting at Castel Gandolfo he's just about to come back as right. we are speaking. And he went on Easter Monday, on Easter Sunday, and then he did the Angelus.
That's right. On
Easter Monday, which is called the Day of the Angel.
That's right.
The day. Monday of the Angel here in Italy. I'd never heard that when I was growing up, and it was only in Italy because of the angel greeting Mary and those who came to the tomb and didn't find Jesus.
That's right.
Well, folks, you know, he's not here. He's risen, as he said he would. So
I found the Via Crucis an extremely suggestive experience.
You know
what I read, Joan? Maybe I got it wrong, but I read that the meditations this year were written by a couple, a 90-year-old
yes.
married couple.
89 and 90.
There you are.
The Zanzuchis. And an amazing, they've been married for over 60 years. They are very active in the Focolare movement, and they found it, as a matter of fact, a movement for within the Focolare. There's this kind of special branch, if you will, for families. And they've been very, very active in that. But I mean, it was really wonderful because, you know what? If you had read the meditations without knowing this fact, I truly think that somebody who paid attention would have guessed that this had to be written by a married couple, somebody who had experienced a life together, the joys, the sorrows, the ups, the downs, the pain, loss, whatever word you want to use. And in 60 years of marriage, obviously you're going to have all of the above and maybe in great quantities. So they were very, very beautiful meditations. And it was wonderful to see the cross being carried around the Colosseum by families.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one that was so moving. The young son was in a wheelchair. And, of course, the parents are there. They gave the cross to the young boy. And then the father pushed him. So you always have the cardinal vicar of Rome behind whoever it is that carries the cross for several meditations. And then after the 14th station, those people wound their way up the hill and gave the cross to the Holy Father at the very end.
But the family was the theme at this 2012.
Yes, oh, exactly. It was the
way
theme
of the cross. Yes.
And there's been a lot of attention on the family.
You
think of the forthcoming. I mean, you just think of Pope Benedict and families and life issues and so forth. And then you've got at the end of May,
right,
or June, and early June, the 7th World Meeting of Families in Milan.
That's right.
And I read yesterday, in fact, I did a brief piece on this. There's a new enchiridion, which I think is a term only used in the church, but I'm not 1,000% sure. And it's really a handbook or a manual. And this book is going to come out, 5,000 copies, prepared by the Pontifical Council for the Family. And it's going to be, among other things, all the writings of John Paul on the family and on life issues, and the writings of Benedict from May 2005 through last December 30th on these issues. There will be separate chapters written by people on delicate issues, abortion, euthanasia, many, many other aspects of family life. There will be chapters on canonically irregular marriages, mixed marriages. If it involves a couple, a marriage, and a family, it's going to be in this book. It's going to be, I understand, it's going to be like the Annuario, and our listeners don't know this, but there's a book called the Annuario Pontificio, the
right,
Pontifical Yearbook. It's like
that's
our Bible,
right.
I mean, really.
But is this enchiridion, you called it, going
yes
to be released
just before the
May
meeting of families? Now, they're only making 5,000 copies. They're not going to be giving this out, obviously, to the participants. I can't tell you right now if it's going to be only in one language or not.
Uh-huh.
Like this Pontifical Yearbook we were just mentioning, that is only in Italian.
Right.
It's a handbook, a manual, a guidebook for us. If you want to know the name of any bishop in the entire world, how many people there are in his diocese, etc., the names and sometimes contacts, for all the people that
absolutely
work in the Vatican,
the colleges,
at Rome.
The
what's
pontifical
about 4 inches thick, isn't it?
Yes, it's
20.
We put our computers on it to jack them up.
Exactly, exactly. And I think it's about, average is about 2,300 pages. So you have the names of all the nuncios, the people representing the Vatican, the people representing their country to the Holy See.
That's right.
It is a
pontifical universities,
right,
all the academic colleges connected to the Vatican.
Exactly. Religious orders. There's pages and pages. And years ago, I probably have to do it again because there's new ones, but years ago, somebody actually asked me for this show. It was when there was a Q&A to Joan Knows. And somebody asked me how many women's religious orders there were in the world and men's. You're not going to believe this. I actually found some quiet time. I sat down and I counted them.
Gosh, do you remember?
There were more women's. It was 740 at that time, like 742 women.
Wow.
And 693 or something, for the men. There were more women. But it's an amazing book. Those of us who, work at the Vatican, cover the Vatican, cannot
be without
this.
Yeah, we all put our names on our own copies. And
oh, yes, this belongs.
Stolen
from Joan. Yes, right. And the interesting thing, too, about that book is that if you look up, like, under the congregations, it lists all the congregations of the Roman Curia. But it'll say, Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Then in small print, for history, please see page 1520 or something like mm-hmm. that. So the history of all these organizations. And it's definitely not something you carry around in your purse. But and apparently this Enchiridion is, this manual is going to be very much like that. So anything
well,
we ever wanted
that
to know about the family, we are going to have in our hands in a couple of months. So,
Joan, you were telling me earlier that you yourself went to the Easter Vigil this year.
I went to an Easter Vigil and went to the North American College. It is so beautiful, but I have to say for everyone to hear, if you want to attend a beautiful liturgy other than obviously a papal liturgy in the Vatican, you go to the North American College.
Can anyone go?
And I was invited this time. If I had known you wanted to go or something, I could have easily called you up and invited you. They'd be more than happy. They have an immensely beautiful big chapel. It's bigger than some churches I've been in. And obviously the men's choir, the liturgist, the director of liturgy is really, really amazing. And you begin in a courtyard outside of the church and the chapel, and of course it's totally pitch dark, and then you start out with your candles. Cardinal Burke presided at this Mass, and I was stunned because Cardinal Burke, the very next morning for the Pope's Mass in St. Peter's Square, Cardinal Burke was right up there with Cardinal Turan. You had two cardinal deacons right with the Holy Father. So he had a late night at the North American and then obviously an earlier morning for the other one. But the vigil is really beautiful. I probably am more of a Sunday morning Mass person simply because when I was born and grew up, there were no evening Masses, prior to Vatican Council II. So that habit was just ingrained, obviously, of going to Mass on Sunday. And I've not been to as many vigil Masses, as beautiful as they are, and it makes me wonder why I don't go more often, because they're beautiful. But about 10 years ago, I was at a vigil Mass in Taiwan.
Gosh.
And that was extraordinary. Just being in Taiwan
was
extraordinary. Because I'd been in mainland China a few years before that. And as part of the Holy See delegation to a conference. But I had about 12 days all at Easter time.
But in what way was that different to the one here?
I can't say I sensed a fervor. It's such a beautiful ceremony. I think I sensed a lot of almost emotion. 34 people came into the church. And you had their families there. You had the church that was receiving them, the joy of receiving someone now into your family, into your home. And it was extraordinarily joyful. Yes, mm-hmm. Very, very beautiful. And I had spent a lot of time getting to know many Catholic groups. There's something like 23 orders of women religious on Taiwan. And the reason there's so many people, so many orders represented, and men too. And they're all learning, those who are not born and raised there, they're all learning Chinese for the day when mainland China opens up and welcomes, Christian and Catholic teachers and priests and nurses and whomever. So I saw a great vibrancy among the faithful there, perhaps because they know that their brothers and sisters, not that many miles away on the mainland, cannot practice their faith openly like they could in Taiwan, like we could in Rome.
But is there an Oriental feel to it in the sense, I don't know, the music?
Oh, yes.
Lighting,
definitely. Yeah. Sure. There is the Oriental touch. And, of course, the fact that you're listening to it in Chinese.
Of course.
You simply have to know the liturgy well enough to know what point you're at. Or every so often you might hear Kyrie eleison and it's, oh, thank you, Lord. Now I know where we are in the Mass. But very, very beautiful. I feel blessed having experienced that, just as having been to the Middle East. Oh, speaking of Middle East, the Pope has announced his trip to, he didn't announce it, but the trip to Lebanon in September has been announced. And simultaneously, by actually the office of the presidency, Michael Schlemann in Lebanon, and the communications office of the bishops' conference there.
Do you remember,
and then the
what
Vatican confirmed it.
He's going to Lebanon?
The 14th to the 16th.
Okay.
And then that'll be a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right.
He will celebrate Mass on Sunday in Beirut. And of course, there'll be bishops from all over the Middle East because the Holy Father is going to sign and then turn over to the bishops the post-synodal apostolic exhortation. Just to remind our listeners that in October 2010, there was a two-week synod in Rome on and for the Middle East. It takes a while. The Pope always writes a document called a post-synodal apostolic exhortation that contains, he bases himself for writing this on what has come to him in the form of suggestions and the ideas that the fathers of the Synod have put forth. So what you read will be a collaborative effort in a way, in that the suggestions and so forth have come to the Holy Father, and then he's woven them all together, you know, in this document. So that will be a fascinating trip to follow. And just because Lebanon itself is so utterly fascinating, and there's about 30% Christians. I'm not sure what how many of those Christians, you know, are Catholic. I don't remember right now.
It's the Maronite Church in Lebanon.
Yes.
It?
You've got the Maronite Rite. You have Melkite. It's absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely the new patriarch. Well, I guess he's been patriarch about a year now, Bishar Arai, of the Maronite Church. And he, when he was here recently in Rome, as other ambassadors and presidents of Lebanon in the last 2 years, they have all asked the Holy Father to come. And this seemed like the perfect occasion and setting, you know, for a trip for the Pope to go and be in a Middle East country. Hopefully all of the political circumstances will allow this, you know, trip to take place. I think we'll all be watching that part of the world,
yes,
as we do anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Shall we wrap up quickly, Joan, with the audience on Wednesday?
You know, this Wednesday, as the Pope always does after Easter and Christmas, he talks about the just past holidays. Of course, we're still actually in Holy Week. And as he does after a trip on the Wednesday audience afterwards, he talks about that. This was really phenomenal. He talked about, again, he said, this audience is marked by the spiritual joy of Easter, born of Christ's victory over sin and death. And he talked about Christ appearing to the disciples in the upper room. He talked about, of course, the disciples on the way to Emmaus, meeting the Lord. But what I found so amazing, the Lord said that the risen one, today too, as then, the risen one enters our homes and our hearts, although at times doors are closed. And of course, actually, part of that reference is to our Lord appearing in the room, not opening a door and walking through, but just appearing in the room. And that really stayed with me. Even though the doors are closed, the Lord's going to come in. You might not want him, or you want to reject him. He's going to come in and be there for when you are ready, you know, to say yes to him. And I thought it was interesting when he said only the risen Christ can remove those sepulchral stones that man places on his feelings, relations, and behaviors. And he named what he called stones: division, hostility, resentment, envy, diffidence, and indifference. And he said, only Christ can give meaning to life and make those who are tired, sad, disheartened, and without hope to resume their journey. So, of course, this audience was outside in St. Peter's Square. And I don't know about you, but I was waiting for the rain to just, oh, my gosh. And actually, I remember looking at the skies and saying, oh, dear Lord, please don't let it rain till about noon. Because that's when
and
the
that's
audience,
what happened, isn't it?
12:10, yes. The heavens opened up at 12:10.
Okay.
And 20,000 pilgrims, if they did not have umbrellas, were, you know, bathed in Roman rain. But at least the weather, thank the Lord, did hold off for all the other ceremonies. Certainly, you know, the Good Friday ceremony. So here we are, looking forward to our upcoming, within hours, celebration of, or actually as we speak, of Divine Mercy Sunday.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much, Joan.
God bless.